The Sherwin-Williams Summer Sale is here. Get 30% off select paints and stains or 35% off our newest product, Emerald Symmetry, July 17th through the 27th. Whether you're refreshing your interior or exterior, we've got the colors to bring your vision to life. And with delivery, getting everything to your door is easier than ever. Shop online to have it delivered or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details. Delivery available on qualifying orders.
Astonishing Legends Network.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. I'm not going to do a ton of housekeeping right now, except to remind you that the Light in the Dark Tour Part 2 2026 is coming. It's going to be the third week of September, between September 13th and September 20th, and it will culminate at the Mothman Festival in Point Pleasant, West Virginia, on the weekend of the 19th and the 20th, where I will be again this year with Susan, meeting all of you and posing for pictures and selling merch and doing a free talk about the making of the movie. And then, of course, that night doing a private show, a personal performance of the podcast for whoever can get a ticket, okay? Now, I haven't locked in all the locations and dates yet, but I want to remind you that the cities I'll be visiting are Toronto, Minneapolis, Chicago, Cleveland, and Pittsburgh, and, of course, Point Pleasant, West Virginia. So if you're in those cities and you want to come out and see Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf live, Toronto, Minneapolis, Chicago, Cleveland, and Pittsburgh, I want to see you. And as soon as I have the dates and the places locked in, you will be the first to know, okay? Doing the live shows is one of my favorite things because I get to stand on a stage and perform. And we kind of figured out last time that these things usually just turn into a hangout with me and Susan and everyone who shows up. So if you can make it, please do. I would love to see you there. More information to come. All right, enough of that. Let's get on with the show. Here we go. The Omega Project by Kenneth Ring, PhD. The Omega Project, William Morrow, 1992, is subtitled Near-Death Experiences, UFO Encounters, and Mind at Large. And it's essentially a book-length study comparing people who have had near-death experiences to people who have had alien abduction experiences. Spoiler alert, it turns out that these people are more alike than they are different. Now, this is weird. After all, alien abductions and near-death experiences are drastically different things. I mean, just look at the book covers. Near-death experience books have clouds on the cover, and their titles are rendered in calming fonts, Ocean Trace or Chicory. Alien abduction books look urgent and lurid, and usually feature a highway running through a dark desert, narrowing to a point on the horizon where it meets the night sky, and up there among the stars are two giant almond-shaped eyes, gazing down, soulless and cold and without mercy. But the real shocker, at least when this book came out, was that there appeared to be a reason behind these events. The angels and aliens were reaching out to us with an urgent message about our ultimate fate, indeed, the fate of the planet. Grim warnings about nuclear war and climate disaster crop up over and over again. Visions of Earth consumed by fire, all humanity, in fact, all living things, obliterated. This seems to be the only thing these strange beings can agree upon. We humans are shitting the bed when it comes to taking care of Earth. And if we don't shape up, like right now, we fucked. This was the message coming at experiencers of all kinds in the late 1970s and early 1980s. Maybe it was the first stirrings of Y2K dread, but it loomed large and it made a dreadful kind of sense. It still does. It speaks directly to something everyone thinks will happen in their lifetime. The end of the world. The origin story of Kenneth Ring's book, The Omega Project, is tailor-made for Richard Haddam's paranormal bookshelf. Here's what happened. It's January 1987. Ring has just returned to work at the University of Connecticut after a long Christmas break. He walks into his office to see a giant mountain of unopened mail waiting for him, and perched on top is a box that unmistakably contains a book. Now, you and I would probably be excited, but not Professor Ring. When a book shows up in the mail for him, it's typically sent by some publisher hoping he'll use the text for one of his classes. In other words, it's a big, unsolicited pain in the ass. He groans and sets the package aside. It's not until much later, when he can't put it off any longer, that he finally opens it and gets quite a shock. Gazing up at him from the cover of the book is, as we know, in his words, quote, an insectoid-looking humanoid with a sickly pale face dominated by a pair of large, impenetrable, black, bug-like eyes. Communion, the title read, a true story. I had never heard of the author, one Whitley Strieber. Oh, brother, I thought, this book is about UFOs. Now, just as he's about to chuck it into the recycling bin, a note falls out from his editor at William Morrow, and the note basically says, wait, don't chuck this into the recycling bin, and don't let the insectoid-looking humanoid with big bug-like eyes on the cover fool you. This book is actually very relevant to your work, and you should read it immediately. Well, this makes absolutely no sense to Dr. Ring. Aside from his work at the university, Ring has spent the past decade studying near-death experiences. He has already published two books on the subject, Life at Death and Heading Toward Omega. And as he well knew, near-death experiences, or NDEs, tend toward the sublime. And in Ring's analysis, they might even be a sort of catalyst for human evolution. His book, Heading Toward Omega, explores this idea head-on. He knows that people who have NDEs experience profound changes in their outlooks on life. A reduced interest in money and material objects, and a greater concern for all human life, and by extension, the survival of the Earth itself. What if these NDEs are, as he puts it, quote, jump-stepping the human race to a higher level of spiritual awareness and psychophysical functioning? Now you might be thinking, but Dr. Ring, what the fuck are you talking about? Don't worry. Dr. Ring explains everything. We'll get to it. But meanwhile, Ring is still staring at that buggy alien and thinking, what the serious fuck? What could UFOs possibly have to do with NDEs? What could these two vastly different phenomena have in common? Ring looks from the note, back to the book, then back to the note. Man, he really doesn't want to read this thing. But he's not going to leave it lying around in his office for just anyone to see. They might think he's crazier than they already do. So he jams it into his bag and he takes the book home. And then a few days later, the way you would approach any unpleasant task like unclogging the garbage disposal or cleaning out the cat box, he decides he may as well get it over with. He starts to read the book. And before he knows it, he's hooked. Completely caught up in Strieber's terrifying account of his nighttime visits from non-human entities. But it's not until later in the book, when Strieber reflects on some possible positive outcomes of these encounters, that Ring realizes there might be a connection here. And by the time he's finished the book, he knows his life is about to change. Maybe for the better, maybe for the worse, but it's going to change in a big way. Because he's about to dip his toe and then eventually dive headlong into a subject he has always held in disdain if he's thought about it at all. After all, he's a university professor and a published author. He's managed to weather the scorn that's been thrown his way for having the nerve to take near-death experiences seriously. But now UFOs and aliens? This is the kind of stuff that ends careers. Was he crazy? Well, yeah, sort of. But as you and I know, you never get to the good stuff by being completely sane. Remember when I said that Ring believed that NDEs might be so transformative that they may actually be some kind of evolutionary trigger point? Well, after reading Communion, he was suddenly pretty sure that alien abductions might be working the same way and leading toward the same end. And that end is what Ring calls Omega, this eventual evolutionary destination. But let's listen to Ring in his own words describe it. Quote, "The Omega Project tells the story of the surprising linkage between NDE and UFO encounters. Hundreds of participants in my research filled out extensive questionnaires designed to explore two areas: factors that predisposed certain individuals to have these experiences in the first place, and how they are affected by these encounters. My study shows unmistakably that there is a distinctive psychological profile for the person who is especially likely to report such experiences. They are what I call an encounter-prone personality, a type of individual who is particularly likely to have extraordinary encounters. They tend to happen to only certain kinds of people." Now, this is a pretty bold statement, and a scary one, because to me, if you say that paranormal experiences only happen to certain kinds of people, you're implicitly suggesting that these experiences are primarily subjective. A skeptic might argue that if there is an objective reality to alien abductions or near-death experiences, it should be equally likely that any person on Earth might have one. After all, hurricanes are objectively real, cancer is objectively real, lottery jackpots are objectively real, and they happen to all kinds of people, not just certain ones. But if these extraordinary encounters are only happening to certain kinds of people, then maybe those particular people are, you know, crazy. Dr. Ring continues, quote, "The Omega Project also considers the effects of these extraordinary encounters, and it is these findings that ultimately reveal their message for humanity at large, the future evolution of our species, and the fate of our planet. What I have found is that something is indeed happening to us as a species as a result of these extraordinary encounters." Well, if his first statement was controversial, this one verges on the totally bonkers. I'm not saying he's wrong, but damn, Dr. Ring, slow your roll. Why don't you buy me dinner on a UFO before you start trying to evolve my whole damn species? Luckily, Ring knows he's got a long road to travel in terms of research before he can promote his big philosophical theories. So he starts laying down his groundwork by comparing accounts of alien abductions and near-death experiences to see if they share any similar underlying structure. And as it turns out, they do. Now, when I first read The Omega Project in the winter of 1999, big things were happening. On Tuesday, January 5th, I got a call from Gary Lucchese at Lakeshore Entertainment. Now, any call placed on the first business Tuesday of the new year means it's important. It cannot wait. It's top priority. And this was. Gary wanted to know if I would be available to fly to Baltimore at the end of the month. He was asking because Lakeshore Entertainment was shooting a film in Berlin, Maryland, something called The Runaway Bride, starring Julia Roberts and her old Pretty Woman co-star, Richard Gere. They'd be doing scenes in Baltimore toward the end of the month, and apparently, I needed to go there and meet with Richard Gere and try to talk him into starring in The Mothman Prophecies. Michelle and I had just gotten back from spending Christmas in Taos, New Mexico. Owen was 2.5, and Spencer wasn't even 1. In that final week of 1998, we spent our days playing in the snow and our nights watching Owen's latest obsession, Dumbo, on VHS, over and over again. And late at night, after the kids went to bed, I would turn off all the lights except for the Christmas tree and sit in the glow of the fireplace and stare out the window at the snow falling in the pine trees and sip on a jalapeno margarita and try to imagine 1999. It's what the entire world was doing. 1999 was the last year of the millennium. Yes, I know that's wrong, but it doesn't matter. That's how we all thought of it. History's odometer was creeping up on the year 2000. We were in the final mile. What was going to happen? Where would we all be in 1 year when the new century started? And what would that new century bring? Yes, again, I know the dates are wrong. The millennium wasn't going to start until 2001, but really, you gotta stop. Anticipating the future with a mixture of dread and pinwheel-eyed terror was what I did every year during the week between Christmas and New Year's. What made this year different was that I was, for maybe the first time ever, hopeful, even a little excited. I had spent the last couple of months of 1998 pitching a new movie all over Hollywood. It was an adaptation of the Nelson DeMille thriller Plum Island. And it was picking up steam just as the holidays started. And just before Christmas, I'd met with a director named George Armitage, who was looking for a writer to adapt a novel by Laurel Dowd called This Body, about a mother of two teenagers who dies of a heart attack and immediately enters the body of a young heroin addict who OD'd at the exact same moment. George and I hit it off, and it looked like we'd be pitching our collaboration to Fox Studios in January. I finally felt like my career had some momentum, and the new year was going to start at full speed instead of having to slowly ramp up. On New Year's Eve, after the kids went to bed, Michelle and I stayed up, talking about the future and adding up money. What if everything happened? What if I sold Plum Island and got hired to write This Body? Two scripts in 1 year? That would effectively double, maybe even triple, what I made last year. And if Mothman moved forward, maybe 1999 was finally going to be my year. Maybe it would be the year that changed everything. On the day that Gary Lucchese called, however, I was still living in the reality of 1998. I was close to broke, again. I told him I wasn't even sure if I could afford the flight to Baltimore. "Lakeshore is paying for your ticket, you dummy," Gary said, or words to that effect. "We're even paying for your hotel and your meals. What do you think of that?" What did I think of that? I thought I'd won the lottery. I'd heard about things like this, people being flown all over the world at the expense of some major film studio. In fact, throughout the 80s and 90s, it was pretty much all I heard about. The perks and extras that got thrown around to actors, directors, and yes, even writers. It was the life I craved and coveted. It was the life I dreamed of. Okay, sure, when I dreamed of it, I wasn't dreaming of Baltimore, but still, it was something. And even better, it felt like the beginning of something. My actual career as a screenwriter. I hung up the phone and ran upstairs to tell Michelle the news. She couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe it. Dreams were coming true. And it must have been at least an hour or two before I started unraveling it all in my mind. "It's never going to happen," I told myself. "It's going to fall through. Richard Gere is going to turn down the part before we even get there." But that wasn't even my major worry. My major worry was so big I didn't even let myself imagine it. Or I didn't up until now. What if they fire me before the trip? The fact was, screenwriters got fired all the time. It was the only thing I knew for sure happened once a movie was in active development. And for first-time screenwriters, it was the rule rather than the exception. I came up with a bunch of arguments for why Lakeshore would do this. Why let some inexperienced goofball fuck this up? What if he says something stupid or comes off as unprofessional and Gere gets cold feet? Better to fire Haddam now and hire someone who has some decent credits and experience and knows what they're doing. And show Gere that we respect him enough to bring out a top-shelf name-brand screenwriter, not the cheap store brand. This is what we call negative thinking. It was the kind of thinking I'd been taught to do my whole life, but especially since I'd been involved in professional entertainment. Be cynical. Be pessimistic. Protect yourself. Expect the worst, and you'll never be disappointed. But for God's sake, at all cost, do not anticipate good fortune. It'll just make it that much more painful when it all comes crashing down. The only problem with negative thinking was that I was tired of it. I had become so good at it that I'd managed to make myself miserable 24 hours a day for the last 6 years, ever since Matt Reeves and I had sold Dark Territory. And in retrospect, when I thought about it, the last 6 years had not been so bad. In fact, to anyone else, they would have seemed pretty good, even enviable. But I'd managed to take what was actually steady progress in my career and my writing and turn it into a self-imposed death march of failure and perceived bad luck. There's something else about negative thinking. It's exhausting. Because for it to work, you have to periodically turn that emotion on its head and manufacture an equal and opposite amount of something called grandiosity, which is the insane belief that not only are you a doomed loser, but also the most talented and gifted person in the universe. That's what allows you to fuel yourself and actually get some work done, so that you can then begin hating yourself again and the work you've done and start anticipating disaster all over again. Now, grandiosity carries its own risks. For years, I walked around with the manufactured conviction that I was 10 feet tall and had a 10-inch dick. Then I got into therapy and calmed down a little and decided I was only 8 feet tall with an 8-inch dick. But then I married Susan Lambert, and now I know. I am 5.5 feet tall. As January rolled on, I tried to manage my expectations, but still, I flinched every time the phone rang. This is the call where you get fired. But it always turned out to be good news. A date was set for George Armitage and I to pitch This Body, and no sooner had I pitched it than I was hired. More companies wanted to hear my pitch for Plum Island, and it seemed like I'd be getting an offer pretty soon. And the trip to Baltimore not only didn't evaporate, but rather took on more and more substance as the weeks went by. Finally, on Wednesday, January 27th, I received a FedEx envelope at my home. I signed for it and opened it, and inside was a first-class plane ticket on United Airlines for Baltimore, Maryland. First class. I had never flown first class before. 1999 was starting out right. I realized I was going to need a book for the flight, and I went through my stack of options. I'd had the Omega Project for almost a year, but I'd never picked it up. Maybe like Dr. Ring felt about communion, I was embarrassed to be seen with it. I thought the title was kind of goofy, but I decided what the hell. I'd give it a try in the airplane, and if it was too boring or weird, I'd just switch over to a James Bond novel. But as luck would have it, just like Ring with communion, once I started, I was hooked. So, as listeners of this podcast know by now, a near-death experience is made up of these elements in roughly this order. 1. A sensation of rising up out of the physical body. 2. The feeling of traveling through a tunnel and approaching a bright light. 3. Meeting a spiritual being or dead relatives. 4. Experiencing a life review where, for better or worse, every moment of your life is replayed for you, and a deeper understanding of your existence is revealed. 5. You are then returned to your body whether you want to or not. And a lot of times you don't want to be returned to your body because, you know, it's all messed up from a car accident or something. Okay, so what's the underlying structure of an alien abduction? Does it even have one? Well, as it turns out, it does. 1. A person is removed from their normal everyday environment. 2. They travel up through a beam of light, or tunnel, if you will, to enter another environment where they, three, submit to an examination. Now, the examination is profoundly physical. The abductee is typically naked. They're helpless and completely under the control of their alien captors. The examination often has a sexual aspect. For women, there's the impression that something has been removed or implanted, and the implication is that this has something to do with the creation of a sort of alien-human hybrid species. For men, sexual material is often removed from the body, against their will, and in the most obvious manner. The male is aroused, and semen is collected. Finally, four. The abductee, male or female, is returned to their original environment. Now, Ring concedes that these two experiences do not on the surface seem the same at all. Most alien abductions are experienced as a kind of horrible nightmare, while near-death experiences are usually described as rapturous and joyful. However, Ring argues that what connects them is that they are both essentially what is known in anthropology as initiatory experiences. So, what's an initiatory experience? Hey, are you guys taking notes? Dude, this is going to be on the final. According to a German psychologist, Holger Kallweit, an initiatory experience is a psychological ordeal that opens a person up to the spirit world and other non-physical realities. It's what a shaman goes through to become, well, a shaman. Holger then provides an example of a shamanic journey. Quote, among the Buryat, the shaman apprentice is visited by the Ucha, his shamanic ancestors. They take his soul to heaven and place it before the assembly of the Sajtani, who torment him in a horrible fashion, poking around his belly with knives, cutting whole chunks of flesh off him, and throwing them about. During these tortures, the shaman can hear his heartbeat, but his breath subsides and his skin becomes dark blue. The spirits cook his flesh to ripen it. The initiate acquires his knowledge during this procedure and becomes conversant with the rules of shamanic wisdom. If you think all of this sounds like a bad acid trip, I would tend to agree with you. And in some cases, these shamanic journeys are launched with the aid of various psychedelic substances. But here's what gets Ring excited. The three-part structure of an initiatory experience is separation, ordeal, and return. And that applies very well to both alien abductions and near-death experiences. Yeah, sure, they feel different, but Ring stresses that the important thing is that people who have near-death or alien encounters all report having been made aware of a larger reality. Their fear has been transformed into wisdom, and they are never the same. Ring argues that people who have gone through one or the other experience are basically a modern-day shaman. Now, I too had been separated from my normal environment. I had been abducted from Alhambra, California, and transported to Baltimore, Maryland. Whether I had an ordeal or if I ever returned remained to be seen. I woke up at 8 a.m. on Saturday morning, January 30th, 1999, in the Hyatt Regency Inner Harbor. I looked out of my hotel room window and saw skeletal letters etched in the sky across the water. Domino Sugars. How strange. Was Baltimore known for sugar? A month ago in Taos, New Mexico, watching the snow fall from a gray night sky, I could never have imagined that I'd find myself in a Hyatt Regency in Baltimore. And it was still only January. The year was already handing me surprises. In 2 hours, we were meeting with Richard Gere in a private dining room in the downstairs restaurant. It would be me, Gary Lucchese, Bob McMinn, and Tom Rosenberg. Those guys were all from Lakeshore. Plus, Carl Franklin, who was attached to direct, and his producing partner and future wife, Jesse Beaton. and, of course, Richard Gere. I thought about calling Michelle when I suddenly remembered that LA was 3 hours behind me. I figured I'd better wait. But I suddenly felt very alone and remote. I took the elevator down to the lobby and found the gift shop open, so I spent longer than I needed to perusing the kids' t-shirts. I got Owen a green Baltimore Orioles shirt with a black and orange bird on the front, an Oriole most likely. Spencer got a onesie with a cool raven on it, which I assumed was a reference to Edgar Allan Poe, but then later found out had something to do with a local football team. Shopping for Michelle was harder. What was I going to get her? A souvenir hat? A shot glass? An ashtray? I was killing time. I was trying to act normal. But in truth, I didn't feel normal at all. I wasn't quite at work, but I certainly wasn't on vacation either. I was starting to get nervous. I checked my watch. 8:40. Still over an hour until brunch, or whatever it was with Richard Gere. I felt the way I usually did before doing a pitch or an open mic night at a comedy club. But in all those cases, I knew what I was doing. I knew my lines. This time I didn't. I didn't know exactly what it was I was supposed to do. Relax, I thought. He's just a normal guy. A human being. Just be normal. You'll be fine. I checked my watch again. 8:42. I did one more lap around the gift shop. At 9:50, I was in the lobby, sitting in a large plush chair facing the elevators. I was waiting for any of the others to come down and lead me to exactly where it was we were all supposed to be meeting. I calculated a slight risk. There was a chance Richard Gere was staying at the hotel. He might be the first one to walk out of the elevators. But luckily, he had no idea who I was or what I looked like. As long as I didn't make eye contact with him, he'd just walk right past me, a total stranger. I liked this. It made me feel invisible, but in a powerful way. A soft bong, and the elevator doors opened. No Richard Gere. I waited. Bong. Another elevator arrived. 3 men in business suits and a woman in a business skirt. It was 7 bongs before Carl and Jesse arrived and walked straight to me. "Are we the first?" he said. "I guess we are," I said. He seemed nervous too, so I immediately felt better. 30 seconds later, Gary Lucchese arrived, then Bob, then Tom. And they all began walking across the lobby and then past the restaurant and then down a side hallway and then into a small dining room with a single circular table set for exactly 7 people. Giant floor-to-ceiling windows looked out into the harbor. We all looked around the room, then at the table, then at each other. A silent strategy was taking place. Where should we sit? Which was just another way of saying, where should Richard Gere sit? And who should sit next to him? No one said a word. Then Tom Rosenberg sat down with his back against the wall. Bob and Gary flanked him. Carl sat down with 2 empty chairs on his right and 1 on his left. And suddenly it all made sense. Jesse would sit next to Richard Gere. I sat down next to Carl on his left. And at that exact instant, Richard Gere entered the room and we all stood up again. Tom, the president of Lakeshore, greeted him first. A warm, friendly hug. They knew each other. Then Gary. Carl stepped in and introduced himself and Jesse. They all shook hands. Then Gary said, "This is Richard Haddam." And Richard Gere shook my hand, made brief eye contact, said a muted hello, and moved on. Finally, Bob said hello, and we all sat back down. I felt like we had all accomplished something, like we'd all made it across some wide, unnamed social chasm and survived. There was perfunctory conversation. How was the Runaway Bride shoot going? How was Julia Roberts? How was Gary Marshall? I sat back. I was safely out of the conversational blast zone. I could stare at my menu and simply observe the proceedings. I observed everyone grinning with nervous energy and talking a little too loud. I observed Richard Gere taking a pair of reading glasses out of his coat pocket and glance at his menu while he answered everyone's questions. A busman served everybody coffee and water, and just as he left, a middle-aged woman entered the room wearing black slacks and a white shirt and a peach-colored apron and bow tie. Our waitress. I saw her eyes rest on Richard Gere as he finished his story, and then she quietly began taking our orders. When she got to Richard Gere, she said a quiet and completely normal, "And for you?" He was just now really looking at his menu, so he waved his hand and said, you can skip me. And that's when she grinned and said, "Oh, I would never skip you, Mr. Gere." And the table went silent. No one made a sound or took a breath. Then Richard Gere lowered his glasses on his nose and turned to really look at her. And then he reached out and put his arm around her waist and pulled her in for a hug and smiled. "I wouldn't skip you either," he said. And a collective sigh went around the table, and then everyone laughed in relief. He had been a good guy. He had saved our waitress from embarrassment and given her a moment she'd talk about for the rest of her life. Richard Gere knew how to be a movie star. The only question now was, would he be one in my movie? Hey, you guys, I am thrilled to tell you that the International Association of Near-Death Studies is hosting their biggest conference ever in Bellevue, Washington, at the Bellevue Hyatt Regency this summer, August 26th to 30th, and you're invited. This event is open to the public. We can go. And the theme this year is Expanded Lives, Exploring the Impact of Near-Death and Related Experiences. You're going to meet regular people who have had NDEs, and you're going to be able to talk to them and find out exactly what happened to them. They're going to have guest speakers like Dr. Eben Alexander, author of the best-selling book Proof of Heaven, Betty Eady, author of the best-selling book Embraced by the Light, and Anita Murjani, author of Dying to Be Me. She has one of the most amazing near-death experience stories I've ever heard. There's even going to be a screening of a new movie, a documentary, about NDE researcher Kenneth Ring, who wrote the book The Omega Project, which, coincidentally, is the next book on our show. He's a total legend. Here's what you have to do. Go to IANDS.org. That's IANDS.org. Click through to events, register, and get an early bird discount. That's IANDS.org. Look, there's going to be an exhibit hall. There's going to be a bookstore. You heard me, a bookstore. There's even going to be parties. Have you ever partied with this crowd? It's unreal. Guys, they've had a near-death experience. They're next level. They've died and come back. They have no fear. I guarantee you cannot keep up with these guys. Go to IANDS.org. That's IANDS.org. And get your early bird tickets for the International Association of Near-Death Studies annual conference this August 26th through 30th in beautiful Bellevue, Washington. It's going to be like you died and went to heaven. See what I did there? What happens when you encounter someone or something you never expected to? And what sort of people have encounter-prone personalities? To find out, Kenneth Ring sent questionnaires to almost 300 people who fell into one of four major categories: UFO experiencers, near-death experiencers, people interested in the subject of near-death experiences, and people interested in the subject of UFOs. Now, the last two categories acted as control groups because these people, while interested in the subject, had never had any direct experiences themselves. The questionnaires were designed to gather information in five areas: paranormal experiences in childhood, the presence of abuse or trauma in childhood, tendencies towards psychological dissociation and fantasy proneness, religious beliefs, and finally, changes in one's physical or psychological state following their extraordinary encounter. including changes in their personal values and interests. The first really interesting result of the tests, at least as far as I'm concerned, is that the experiencers were not, as children, what is called fantasy prone. They did not identify themselves as having vivid imaginations, a rich fantasy life, or being prone to daydreaming. However, there was a distinct indication that as children, experiencers felt that they were, quote, aware of alternate realities. Now, you might hear that and think, wow, that sounds like being fantasy prone to me. But you'd be wrong. For instance, one of the most common non-ordinary childhood events reported by people in the study involves the sighting or awareness of non-physical beings. What distinguishes these reports is that the encounters were not experienced as dreams or fantasies, but rather as completely real and often repeated events. In other words, the respondents were very aware of what dreaming and daydreaming felt like as children, and according to them, this felt completely different. You might be thinking, well, what about imaginary friends? Kids think those are real. Wrong again. As it turns out, while it's fairly common for children to have imaginary friends, the children are completely aware that their friends are imaginary. Children don't actually experience their imaginary friends as being real. Imaginary friends are indicative of a fantasy-prone personality type. Repeated and uninvited visits from non-physical beings are not. Here's an example of the latter. Quote, on my third birthday, my mother gave me a party. That night, I was too excited to sleep. My bed was under a window. As I looked up at the sky, three lights became bigger and brighter and closer. They came close to my window and hovered there. Then they turned into people shapes. The people told me that Earth is a school, and they had brought me there to learn. They told me that I would experience many difficult things, that I would meet strange people, and that my task was to learn to love them, regardless of what they did. They told me that no matter what happened, my true self would never be touched. Then they left. To me, what makes this story so compelling is that it doesn't sound like a kid's fantasy. The people who show up at her window don't offer to grant her wishes or ask her to come out and play. They lay down some harsh, weird-sounding, grown-up philosophy and then bugger off. It just doesn't feel like the kind of thing a three-year-old would come up with on their own. One other thing. Did you notice how this story sounded like an almost exact mixture of a UFO experience and a near-death experience? It's almost hard to know how to categorize it. Maybe these things are more connected than we thought. Another significant, but by no means universal, factor in the childhood lives of experiencers is the relatively high levels of childhood abuse and/or trauma. Now, Dr. Ring stresses that while child abuse and trauma apparently play a role in promoting sensitivity to extraordinary encounters, quote, I do not intend to serve the interest of those who would pathologize these experiences or denigrate the individuals who report them. Now, I'm about to get into some deep psychological waters, and for reasons of brevity and clarity, I'm going to try to simplify things, but because we're also touching on some hot-button issues like child abuse, including sexual abuse, I want to be careful not to oversimplify things. With this in mind, let's find out how a person might become encounter-prone. We'll invent a person, and we'll call them Alex. As a child, Alex reports to have had at least some natural ability to perceive alternate realities, like the kid in the story we just heard. And yes, in this case, we're going to assume there are alternate realities to perceive. We can even give Alex a specific experience. Now, this one actually belongs to a 37-year-old librarian in Virginia, a well-adjusted college graduate now, happily married with children of her own. Here's her story from childhood. When I was around age 8, two beings, one male and one female, started appearing to me. This always happened outdoors and in a particular area of the farm I lived on. They would speak to me telepathically. They said they were from a place named Zenith, just like the TV, and that they were my, quote, true parents. My relationship with them was quite extensive and went on for about 3 years. They said they loved me and protected me. Then, when I was 10, a new entity began to come to me. He was very tall and looked like a Bigfoot, hairy and ape-like. We communicated telepathically, too. He claimed to be my protector, and he said he loved me just as my Zenith parents did. He was with me briefly, maybe a year or so, at most. Okay, so Alex is experiencing a very real encounter with alternate realities. Now, let's say Alex becomes quite ill and is hospitalized for most of a year. Their disease is life-threatening, their treatment is difficult, and they are in pain and discomfort a lot. So, you can think of that as trauma. Alex dissociates from the overwhelming stress of their environment. Dissociation is a form of psychological fragmentation in which one portion of the individual self splits off from the conscious self. And by the way, there are levels of dissociation. It's something we all do to some degree every day. And it's not in and of itself pathological. But the ability or tendency to dissociate has been found to be a common feature of the encounter-prone personality. And a childhood illness or abuse can be an antecedent of this tendency. Now, Alex's tendency to dissociate is a means of psychological defense. And can anyone blame them for tuning out the stressors in their real life? But in doing so, it turns out Alex may be more able to now tune in to other realities where they can temporarily feel safe. Alex needs one other thing to be an encounter-prone personality. And this final thing is psychological absorption. And this is the ability to focus one's attention on the features of one's inner reality to the exclusion of things taking place in the outside world. Activities like writing, dancing, art, and music often foster absorption. So, if and when these three factors come together, Alex might just be what Ring calls an encounter-prone personality. Now, you might think that with all these things going on in Alex's life, that Alex might just be fucking nuts. So much so that they're seeing aliens every day. But that just isn't the case. An exterior stressor or stimulus is required for Alex to experience a, quote, large-scale encounter, like a near-death experience or a full-blown alien abduction. And here, of course, is where we move from the subjective to the objective. For alien encounters, the stimulus is often a strange light seen in the sky. For near-death experiences, it is obviously a near-death incident. When this stimulus occurs in Alex's life, they enter an altered state of consciousness. And it is in this altered state that Alex has, depending on the stimulus, either a near-death experience or an alien encounter. And while there are extremely rare cases in which a single person has experienced both, people like Alex overwhelmingly tend to have one experience or the other exclusively. But I want to make one thing clear. Not all people with encounter-prone personalities go on to have large-scale encounters. And perhaps the real shocker here is that the majority of people who have encounters are not encounter-prone personalities. According to Dr. Ring's study, the numbers top out at about 35%. That's a lot, but what about the other 65%? Well, guys, those folks are just like you and me. So why all the fuss? Why did Ring work so hard to find the thing that linked all, or most, or at least a big chunk, of people who have had extraordinary encounters? Well, I think it was mostly to learn something about the phenomenon itself. But along the way, he discovered something astounding, that there may be a reason for these encounters to be taking place at all. In his book, the people having the experiences that Ring surveys are the stars. They're the whole reason the book exists. And Ring definitely treats them as special. But I found myself wondering if they felt special. Do these modern-day shamans feel like shamans? Or do they feel more like metaphysical hit-and-run victims, more cursed than blessed? As we know, the messages they received were about imminent global catastrophe. It's been over 30 years. Are they relieved? Disappointed? Or are they waiting, still waiting, to learn how it all works out? My encounter with Richard Gere, as it turned out, didn't end with breakfast. No sooner had it wrapped up than we all made plans for dinner. After a day of mostly hanging around my hotel room, it was now full dark, and I was walking to a restaurant, a block or so off the Inner Harbor. If I had been nervous about talking to Mr. Gere, I wasn't anymore. And whatever fantasies I had about being the one expected to reel him in were now gone. Once breakfast was served and the conversation continued, I didn't end up talking to him at all. And it became clear to me that my presence wasn't required, and if anything, it had been a formality that I was invited on the trip at all. I couldn't tell if I was relieved or insulted. For 2 years, this script was all I had thought about. There wasn't a single sentence, not a word I hadn't agonized over. I could defend every thought, every theme, every line of dialogue. No one in the world knew this script or this story better than me. But now it was slowly becoming apparent to me that my contribution to this project was seen as something that had happened in the past. I had given birth to it, but it was now in the hands of other more important players, the producers, the director, the star. If further work was required, it could now be done by virtually anyone. The car was built, someone else was now driving, and if repairs were needed, mechanics were easy to come by. Again, this was not a novel insight. It was the truest of all Hollywood truisms. When it came to movies, writers were disposable in a way that actors and directors were not. I would simply have to accept that at a certain point, and that point was coming soon, I was going to have to release this thing, my creation, into the care of others. I remembered how disappointed Matt and I were when Dark Territory got transformed from a cool, fun, diehard movie into a semi-functional Steven Seagal flick. But to a certain extent, what had we really expected? We had written a big action movie, and they had made a big action movie. And the fact that it didn't feel like the one we had imagined while writing it didn't matter to anyone but us. Now, I figured that with the Mothman prophecies, I had at least a slight edge, and that the script was so idiosyncratic. Its uniqueness was really all it had going for it. Mess with that too much, and why even bother making it? But still, if it got made, and that was still a very big if, would it be mine? Would the small things remain? Would it say the things I wanted it to say? Would it feel the way I wanted it to feel? Grow up, Adam. You're in Hollywood now. Well, Baltimore, but still. They were at least going through the motions of respecting me as part of the creative team. No matter how much I felt like the old boyfriend, I was still here. It was still a big step up from Under Siege 2. I found the restaurant and pushed through the glass and brass doors into the warm, noisy bar. It was exactly 7 p.m., and as usual, I was the first to arrive. So I waited there feeling awkward and out of place until, one by one, the rest of them showed up. This must have been a very popular restaurant, because even after Richard Gere arrived and demonstrated his gearness to all within view, they still made us wait 5 minutes before bringing us to our table, just off the bar. The room was dark and crowded, and the ceiling was low, and the table glowed with candles in yellow glass votives. Richard Gere sat at the far end of the table, and I instinctively took the seat furthest from him, anchoring the other end. Once we were all seated, I noticed the vibe was completely different from our morning meeting just 8 hours ago. Everyone was relaxed, no hints of awkward formality. We were all friends now. Bottles of wine appeared on the table, and the waiter filled my glass, and I wasted no time emptying it. The way I saw it, if everyone else thought my work was done, then my work was done. I was going to enjoy this. For the first time in my life, I had a seat at the cool table. I could see the people around me recognizing Richard Gere one by one. In LA, no one would have blinked an eye, but this was not business as usual in Baltimore. Once they saw Gere, they started looking around the table to see if any of the rest of us were famous. I knew what they were thinking. I don't recognize anyone, but if they're with Richard Gere, they must be important. I could feel the wine warming my stomach and seeping into my blood. Enjoy this dinner, buddy. It might be all you get. I ordered a giant ribeye steak and finished another glass of wine and spent the entire meal talking with Carl Franklin's producing partner, Jesse Beaton, and Bob McMinn, the only executive at Lakeshore who had actually read the book The Mothman Prophecies and had read it years ago, not just because his company had bought my script. In fact, as the evening went on, I began to suspect that his knowledge and interest in Keel's book was probably a huge factor in their decision to buy it. The three of us got along great, and we wandered deep into the weeds about the book and Keel and UFOs and whether any of us had ever had any supernatural experiences. The food and the wine and the conversation were doing their work on me. I was feeling good. At least in this moment, at this corner of the table, I was still considered the final authority on Mothman and ultra-terrestrials and what it all might mean. I must have been getting progressively louder because I noticed that one by one, the others at the table had turned and were listening to me. Richard Gere, whose wine glass was also empty, was staring down at me along the table of blurry glowing candles and quiet faces and plates of mostly finished food. "So what's it about then?" he said. "At the end of the movie, what's the answer?" "Really? Now he's asking me? We haven't said two words to each other all day. And now, after I've put away half a bottle of wine and 20 ounces of steak, he's asking me what my movie is all about." Everybody stared at me. They were all waiting for the answer. Perfect, I thought. The moment I've been waiting for 2 years. I was warmed up. I was oiled and fed. I was at cruising attitude. I was ready. "The answer is, there is no answer," I said. "There are mysteries all around us that as human beings, we will never fully understand." I was pleased with myself because I was finally getting to articulate in front of everyone one of the most important things about the movie, that it wasn't going to wrap up neatly and answer every question. That was my whole point. Richard Gere leaned forward in his chair, slapped his hands down on the table, and said, "That's where you're wrong, because I believe you can." Because of course he does, I thought. He's a Buddhist. Attaining total knowledge while on the human plane is a cornerstone of his religion. But the Mothman Prophecies isn't about Buddhism. It's about a man struggling with the paranormal. "I believe you can too," I said, and then repeated it like this. "I believe you can. But the character of John Klein isn't there yet. If he's on a journey of enlightenment, it starts the minute the movie ends." The table fell silent. Then someone said, "Jesus Christ, I didn't know we were going to get into religion." And everyone laughed, and the moment passed, and people slowly returned to their other conversations. I sat back. I had just done something either very smart or very stupid. But in that moment, I didn't much care. What was going to happen would happen, and I knew the degree of control I had over it was very small. In the end, I had done the only thing I ever truly wanted to do, the only thing I knew how to do. I had stood up for my work. I walked home to the hotel after dinner with Carl and Jesse and Tom and Gary and Bob. But then I slipped away and walked out to the end of the pier that ran straight out into the harbor. I looked out across the harbor at the Domino Sugars sign glowing red in the night sky. There was a perfect upside-down reflection of it on the water's surface. I loved that sign, I decided. It was mine. This moment was mine. Everything was starting to happen. Dreams really were coming true. Yeah, I thought, but what's coming next? Stop it, I thought. Stop projecting into some awful future. Stop hurting yourself. For all you know, things are going to work out great. In the back of my mind, I thought about Michelle and the boys. And what's going to happen there? A different voice asked. That's going to be okay too, I thought. Especially if this movie gets made. My first real movie, just me. The start of my career as a solo screenwriter. Success, money, everything will be okay. Please, God, let it be okay. I looked back up at the sign and thought, someday I'm going to come back here. I'm going to walk out on this pier and look at that sign, and I will know everything. I will know how it all turned out. I'll know the answer. I stayed for a few more minutes, but finally the cold got to me, and I walked back to the hotel and my room. And then I decided, what the hell, and ordered a giant hot fudge sundae from room service. Compliments of Lakeshore Entertainment. When I'm sitting here writing the podcast, I will suddenly be starving, and that is my danger zone. Because that's when I will literally go into the kitchen and grab a bag of Doritos and just eat the whole thing. Don't do that. It's not good for you. It's not good for me. And that's why the Cumin Club is a lifesaver. You add water, you put it in the microwave. 5 minutes later, you're eating it. It's a delicious Indian meal you can feel good about. Here's what you do. Click on the link in my show notes or simply go to thecuminclub.com. And put in the offer code RHPB, that's going to get you 30% off. I'll say it again. Go to thecuminclub.com or click on the link in my show notes and enter the offer code RHPB and you're going to get 30% off. Not on your first order, not in your first two orders. You're going to get 30% off every single time you order. They're going to deliver it right to your door. Eat something good. Healthy and delicious. You deserve it. You're going to feel good about it. The Cumin Club, authentic Indian flavors straight from the source to your door. Toward the end of the Omega Project, Kenneth Ring focuses on the final factor that links near-death and alien abduction experiencers, messages and visions of global catastrophe. Betty Andreessen, one of the most famous UFO abductees of all time, perhaps second only to Whitley Strieber, contends that her abductors have made this point explicit. Quote, "They say that they are the caretakers of nature and natural forms. They call themselves the Watchers. They love mankind. They love the planet Earth, and they've been caring for it and man since man's beginning. Man is destroying much of nature." In Raymond Fowler's book about her entitled The Watchers, Bantam, New York, 1990, he states, quote, "Her abductors assured her that their abductions of men and women were for good reasons. It was being done to monitor environmental effects on the body and to achieve restoration of the human form. Again, they stressed, perhaps for the very last time, that the balance of nature on Earth was in jeopardy. The acceleration of UFO activity is directly related to man's increasing destruction of Earth's life-supporting environment. Man must engage in an immediate and all-inclusive program to repair and protect the environment." The Omega Project was published in 1992, but millennial fears were already gaining steam. The clock was ticking in just about every way you can imagine. And by 1999, the suspense had become unbearable. Something was going to happen. It had to. Otherwise, why bother dividing up time into 100-year chunks? The most frightening aspect of all this worry was how self-fulfilling the prophecies began to seem. We were all so absolutely sure we were headed toward disaster that it began to feel like somebody somewhere was going to make it happen just to prove us all right. And the ultimate irony of the Y2K drama was that it appeared we had done just that. We had thoughtlessly embedded disaster into our computers and then let them take over our lives to such an extent that we would ultimately prove to be the unwitting authors of our own doom. Now, as it turned out, Y2K fears were a bust. No nationwide blackouts, no planes dropping from the sky. And we all took a deep, relieved breath. Then, in the real first year of the millennium, 2001, we learned that sometimes disaster isn't averted. It's just delayed. A quarter of the new century has now passed, and as of this writing, there has been no nuclear annihilation, and the environmental destruction of Earth has proven to be real, but slow rolling. The world staggers forward, as do we all. Do we have a choice? I've always had trouble imagining the future, especially my own. But in the years since that weekend in Baltimore, so much has happened. The Mothman prophecies did eventually get made, with Richard Gere, but not with Carl Franklin. And I did eventually get fired. But the version of the movie that was released turned out to be everything I had hoped for. I got divorced and remarried, and spent most of the next 25 years working in television. The word podcast didn't exist in 1999, but it's that word that finally brought me into spaces and places where people who loved the Mothman prophecies became an everyday part of my life. And just last year, in 2025, I finally made it to Point Pleasant, West Virginia, to be a special guest at the Mothman Festival, a joyous celebration of our favorite cryptid and all his cryptid buddies. And it never would have existed if not for the movie getting made, which in turn made Mothman into a household word. Susan and I spent that whole weekend in Point Pleasant and then drove through West Virginia all the way to Washington, D.C., where we met up with Scott Philbrook and Tess Feifel and Kayla Lord and had a mini Astonishing Legends / RHPB reunion after my live show at Kramer's Books. Now, could I ever have imagined that all those years ago? The next day, we drove from Washington, D.C. to New York City, following the little blue line on my smartphone. And smartphones didn't exist in 1999. And I guess I'm glad they do now, but they cheat me of the bird's eye view of a long car journey that only fold-out maps can give you, and because of this, I almost missed it. As we sped up Interstate 95 in the fading light of late September, something flashed in my peripheral vision, something red and glowing, like Mothman's eyes. I glanced to my right, and that's when I saw it. And when I realized what it was, a chill ran through me, and my heart skipped a beat. It was the Domino Sugar sign. Somehow, I was in Baltimore for the first time in 26 years. I stared at the sign, but something was wrong with it. The letters were all backward. And that's when I realized I was on the other side of it, seeing it from behind. Looking through it, back across the Inner Harbor, toward the Hyatt Regency and the pier where I had stood a quarter of a century earlier. A young man, waiting for my life to finally start, and wondering how it would all turn out. and now I finally knew. It turned out great. Thank you for joining me on Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf. Richard Haddam's Paranormal Bookshelf is presented by Astonishing Legends, 134 West, and Summerland Entertainment. Executive producers Scott Philbrook, Forrest Burgess, and Susan Lambert. Our associate producers are Tess Feifel, Sailor Franklin, and Harrison Marks. Our sound designer, editor, and engineer is Kevin Ducey. Artwork is by Tommy Beaver. Our website is by Kayla Lord. And our music, as always, is by Nima Kazzaruni. Please join us next time when we delve into Stanley Milford Jr.'s The Paranormal Ranger. Until then, be safe and be well, find the light in the dark, and we'll see you again soon.
Third Love makes bras that actually fit, so they know this. If your bra feels uncomfortable, the problem isn't your body, it's your bra. Third Love designs for comfort first. Soft fabrics, support that doesn't dig, pinch, or slip. Bras that feel good and look good under everything you wear. Shop Third Love and explore over 60 sizes, including AA through H, and half cup sizes you won't find anywhere else. Get $15 off your first purchase at thirdlove.com with code PODCAST15.
Here's what happened when one journalist reported on DEI programs.
I decided to just focus on the University of Michigan. I obtained internal documents that showed that the school had spent about $250 million on DEI programs. I spent 2 weeks in Ann Arbor talking to everybody I could find. The unintended consequences of these programs, they had sort of left everybody dissatisfied. And this expensive machinery the school had built just imploded. If you're a journalist, you are not on anyone's team. All you're trying to do is figure out as many of the facts as you can gather. The facts are going to guide you to where the story lands. You're not taking sides. I'm Nick Confessori. I'm an investigations reporter for the New York Times.
Journalists like Nick follow the facts wherever they lead. They go where news breaks, get answers firsthand, and publish what they find. That's fact-based reporting. Seek it out if you don't already.
Ahora en McDonald's, te puedes llevar un $5 McChicken Meal Deal o un $6 McDouble Meal Deal. Así, hay algo para todos. Llévate más por tu dinero con tu Meal Deal. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba. Solo por tiempo limitado. Precios y participación pueden variar. Precios con entrega pueden ser más altos.